This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When Rebecca Clayfish entered the race for governor, she was the presumed Republican frontrunner. But now the former lieutenant governor may be at risk of losing her primary campaign. As she closes out the race, she's reminding voters of the work she did with former Governor Scott Walker more than a decade ago. As Sean Johnson reports, the question now is whether that will work.
There have been big events during Rebecca Clayfish's 2022 run for governor that have not broken her way. But in the closing weeks of her primary campaign, there are little moments that have Clayfish feeling like it's 2010 all over again. During an interview at a recent GOP picnic in Verona, Clayfish gets interrupted from across the park, but in a good way.
You know, we put... Thank you. Love you guys. Tell your friends August 9th, please.
Clayfish says moments like these remind her of her first run for office in 2010.
And there was a moment at which you could feel almost palpable momentum on the ground, and it's stuff like that.
2010 was the year Clayfish jumped headfirst into politics. She won a crowded GOP primary for lieutenant governor and joined Scott Walker's ticket. She was there in 2011 when Walker introduced Act 10, his landmark bill that all but eliminated public sector union rights. And they both survived historic recall elections in 2012.
Now this is what democracy looks like!
After Walker narrowly lost to Democratic Governor Tony Evers in 2018 and later announced he would not run in 2022, Clayfish became the presumed frontrunner. She's since been endorsed by a long list of Republican power brokers, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the business giant Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and most prominently, Walker.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. Please join me in voting for Rebecca Clayfish for governor. Rebecca stood with me as we took on the big government special interest and cut taxes.
With each endorsement has come an overt reminder that Clayfish was there a decade ago when Republicans won control of state government and fundamentally changed Wisconsin. Longtime GOP operative Brian Schimming says it's an effective way for Clayfish to remind voters of her record.
You know, there's a reason she's got him out front as much as she does, and that is he still is very powerful motivator with Republican primary voters. And the grassroots, 100% name ID.
But Schimming says there are reasons Walker's support and Clayfish's record weren't enough to clear the field. Being lieutenant governor isn't quite the same as being governor, he says. There's also the old adage.
For some folks, it's the oldest thing in the book. That was then and this is now. And
the Republican Party of 2022 is different from the party of 2010. Walker and Clayfish won with a base of support in the suburbs. Republicans still turn out the vote there, but not by quite as much. Meanwhile, at least some GOP voters actively dislike all of Clayfish's establishment ties. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha.
Those who were standard bearers before are not necessarily in the positions that they had been in terms of what their endorsements mean, what kind of popularity they have.
Clayfish also missed out on the biggest endorsement when former President Donald Trump backed her opponent, construction executive Tim Michels. Michels, who only entered the race in April, has since spent millions of his own money on ads and shot up in the polls. But when asked why she wasn't able to put this race away earlier, Clayfish rejects the premise of the question.
Nobody's entitled to anything. Things must be earned, and there's no one who can outwork me.
That was who she was in 2010, Clayfish says. That's who she is now. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR is running a series of profiles ahead of Wisconsin's August 9th primary election. We'll continue to profile Republicans running for governor over the course of this week. Now, U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has planned a trip to Taiwan next month, creating political controversy in China and in the U.S. The Chinese government has threatened consequences if Pelosi visits the island. Taiwan is self-governing, but China claims it as its own. President Biden has said the U.S. military does have some concerns about the proposed trip. An official of Pelosi's rank hasn't visited Taiwan in over 25 years since the Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich made the trip. Her planned visit comes at a time when tensions between the U.S. and China are high. You can join the show at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Should the U.S. play a strong role in supporting Taiwan? Do you worry about provocation from China in the region? What do you want to know about how Taiwan fits into U.S.-China relations? Call 800 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science at Temple University, where she co-directs the Certificate in Political Economy. Her new book is called Micro-Institutional Foundations of Capitalism, Sectoral Pathways to Globalization in China, India, and Russia. Rosalind, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the latest news this week, a big picture. Taiwan is in a very unique position. It is an independently functioning government. China claims it. A lot of the world has to sort of pretend it doesn't exist and yet interact with it. Can you talk about the status of Taiwan a little bit?
Yeah, so as you mentioned already, Taiwan is an independent governing country, and in many ways it is independent and sovereign. It has its own economy, it has its own military, and so one way to kind of periodize U.S.-China relations, U.S.-China-Taiwan relations, would be to look back a few decades into the end of the 1970s. That's in 1978 when the United States normalized diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. And that was at the time during Jimmy Carter's administration when the Taiwan Relations Act was voted into law by the US Congress. And so essentially since the normalization of diplomatic relations and the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States in many ways have danced around this kind of policy of strategic ambiguity, in the sense that we, the United States, engages diplomatically and economically with China, which at that time was about to, open its open door policy and integrating into the global economy. But because of China's claim over the sovereignty of Taiwan, the United States officially has diplomatic relations with Taiwan, nor does it officially recognize Taiwan's independence, even though, as you mentioned, Taiwan is independently governed.
So why would China be particularly concerned about a U.S. Speaker of the House and other members of Congress paying an official visit to Taiwan?
So, in China's mind, having kind of one of the top executive officials, elected officials in the United States visit, as you mentioned earlier, the last time was in 1997 when Newt Gingrich visited Taiwan. To have a top official visit, in their mind, it is, essentially the United States officially diplomatically engaging Taiwan. And, with China's sovereign claim over Taiwan, this is something that China is unhappy about. But, in many ways, we could characterize what Pelosi is doing and situating it in what the Fed President Janet Yellen spoke about or recently advocated, which is what she called friend shoring. And this is the idea that we focus on trading and investing with our allies and not our geopolitical rivals. And so Pelosi going to Taiwan, taking a trip to an allied country, is in a sense recognizing Taiwan as an important node of the global supply chain. So in some ways, it is not about, intentionally provocating China, but rather, executing what the U.S. Economically, strategically is doing, which is focusing on trading and investing with our allies during a time of war.
Rosalind Shea is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relations and Taiwan as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and possibly other members of Congress looking at a possible visit to Taiwan next month. China not happy about the notion, the leadership there. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China? What questions do you have about this fairly sensitive and complicated bit of U.S. foreign policy and how it affects our economy, too? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk about Taiwan and U.S.-China relations with Rosalind Shea, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. Things are tense already. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi looking at a possible trip to Taiwan. China criticizing that notion. Concerns about some sort of military escalation or at least provocation. You could join in with your thoughts on all that, your questions for our guest right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rosalind, I assume, or I understand, internally in China now, there's a big deal coming up, a big party meeting where President Xi Jinping is looking at trying to have an unprecedented third term as president of that country. How important is that timing when it comes to China's reaction to this planned trip to Taiwan?
And certainly with the party congress coming up, Xi Jinping will have to appear to the domestic audience that he is taking a strong stance in regards to any quote-unquote provocations in regards to Taiwan. And, you know, with the geopolitical tensions right now, in many ways, Xi Jinping is forced to do, rhetorically anyway, to respond to what China is now characterizing as provocations. Now, in terms of what really, in fact, may in fact happen, I do not believe, and developments do not reveal that, in fact, China will, you know, will act militarily just because Nancy Pelosi takes this trip to Taiwan.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if we could have a little conversation. If we are going to take diplomatic approaches towards situations, and as situations get more and more tenuous, what is the status of our ability to have really good diplomacy on a world scale?
Mike, thanks for the call. Rosalind, can you talk about the state of U.S. diplomacy, our relationships with China? I know President Biden, I believe, expected to talk to the Chinese president as soon as tomorrow.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, we do have, you know, open dialogue with China. In fact, as, you know, planned, Biden will have a conversation with Xi Jinping tomorrow. And in terms of relations with our allies around the world, the Asia Pacific, in particular, in May, when Biden visited Asia, he rolled out the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is essentially focused on diplomatic relations with countries in Asia, with the objective of diversifying supply chains and markets for the U.S. And in part, it is, you know, in light of the geopolitical situation with the war going on in Russia and Ukraine, but it's also in response to Biden administration's response to what the China's increasingly closed economy focused on promoting indigenous industry that it can control. And so, as I have written about in my previous book, China's Regulatory State, and then also in my new book, Microinstitutional Foundations of Capitalism, what we have seen is that since that open door policy in 1978 that I mentioned earlier, China has really taken a liberalization two-step, which is, you know, it integrating into the global economy, part of being part of the WTO, courting foreign direct investment, but then all around the same time in parallel re-regulating. And so we had the Trump administration, for example, responding to that re-regulation, that kind of closing in of the Chinese markets and trade to foreign direct investment. The Trump administration responded to that with the U.S.-China trade war. Biden, on the other hand, is now focusing on what he's calling Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is diversifying supply chains and having more of a emphasis on trade relationship with Asia Pacific. And along the same lines, as I mentioned earlier, the Fed president, Janet Yellen, is now advocating friendshoring. And so it's all along that same lines of let's focus on relationship, economic and political, diplomatic with our allies in the Asia Pacific, as well as our allies around the world. And by doing so, then we could face our geopolitical rivals.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in La Crosse. Chris, hello.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chris?
Well, I in 2012, I was out at Fort Lee, Virginia at the Logistics University for the military, and we had military guests from Taiwan there, and I was just curious, is how has the relationship changed from then to now if they're not recognized as their own entity, and or am I incorrect in understanding that, or what's going on there?
Chris, thanks for the call. Rosalind, as I understand it, the U.S. does supply military supplies to Taiwan. The kind of cooperative training exercises Chris mentioned, I think, might still go on, even though, again, we don't necessarily say Taiwan is a country.
Right. You're certainly right. In the context of strategic ambiguity, we also have in parallel the Taiwan Relations Act, which was voted into law in the U.S. Congress in 1978. And essentially, the Taiwan Relations Act commits the United States to selling weapons to Taiwan to maintain its self-defense capabilities, and it also empowers the United States to, you know, appropriately decide, U.S. Congress and the president together, to appropriately decide if for any reason that self-defense capacity changes in order to maintain peace and security in the Western Pacific area. And so indeed, the Taiwan Relations Act maintains military exercises, the selling of weapons to Taiwan for self-defense capabilities. And if, you know, that kind of defense, self-defense orientation changes, then the president and the United States Congress together can appropriately decide on solutions, and which could include military if it means that we need to do that to maintain peace and security. And all of this is empowered by the Taiwan Relations Act.
Chris, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Rosalind Shea from Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relations, Taiwan, a possible visit by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress there next month, and objections from Chinese leadership to that possible visit. Rosalind, you mentioned military action from China you don't see as being very likely. One scenario that has people concerned is that China might step up its claims to waterways that most of the world looks at international waters. China says, nope, Chinese waters, and trying to assert that in some way, you know, not a full on military escalation, but something that would be worrisome, economically disruptive at the very least. Do you see that as a possible response from China?
You know, it's always possible. And in many ways, for those of us who've been watching developments around the world, China has already began to do such steps in other parts of the world, including in and around the Arctic Circle. And so if China does indeed do that, that wouldn't be something that's necessarily new. If China does do that, you know, that it would be considered by the United States as a provocation began by China. And again, relying on the Taiwan Relations Act, that would disrupt the self-defense capability of Taiwan.
We had a comment from Chris in Reedsburg, who is asking for a little overview of why China and Taiwan are in this situation in the first place, where they're separate countries, but China claims Taiwan. Can you sum up some of the early history that led to this current situation?
Yeah, so, you know, we could begin with the end of World War II. The current, you know, the Republic of China government that's on Taiwan, which actually had ruled Taiwan under martial law for 40 years and underwent democratic transition in the 1990s, that Republic of China government was headed by Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang Kai-shek was in a civil war with Mao Zedong in the People's Republic of China, what, you know, called mainland China, until the end of the Chinese Civil War and the end of World War II. And at that time, the United States, Chiang Kai-shek being an ally of the United States, and at the end of World War II, the United States essentially permitted the control of Taiwan to Chiang Kai-shek. And so since Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan in 1949, Taiwan and China have been governed separately. And in fact, really, Taiwan has been governed separately since the end of the 19th century in 1895 when, you know, Japan came under, when Taiwan came under Japanese colonial control at the end of the Russo-Japanese War. But, you know, let's not go all the way back. Let's just focus on World War
II. Rosalind, are you still
half
there?
Half century and beyond. Yes, I'm here. Essentially, in the last half century and beyond, Taiwan and China have been governed separately, and China has been laying claims over Taiwan.
In just our last minute or so, Rosalind, what are you watching for next as this story moves ahead over the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I'm watching to see what, you know, whether Nancy Pelosi will indeed take this trip, whether the Biden administration and Nancy Pelosi, Janet Yellen, and other administrators would be able to characterize and frame this trip as really about promoting global liberalism, about promoting, you know, investing and trading with our allies, and really, you know, painting a picture and framing this about the United States being for free trade and democracy.
Rosalind, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science at Temple University. She talked to us about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's potential trip to Taiwan and how it's highlighted current tensions in the U.S. relationship with China.